Hang the Jew or We'll Hang You? Was there a mob of anti-Semites at the trial? Quote, "When the law is on your side, argue the law. When the facts are on your side, argue the facts. When neither the law nor the facts are on your side, create confusion." End quote. Lawyer's adage. There is almost no acceptable way to view the Leo Frank murder trial except as a month-long riot of anti-Semitic, violence-filled death threats to the judge, intimidation of the jury, and outright persecution of the innocent Jewish defendant. So much of the literature on the case from so many respected sources insists on a violent anti-Semitic backdrop that it has become the unquestioned and unassailable official version. Typical of those, quote, authoritative, end quote, accounts is this one from the prestigious American Jewish Historical Society, AJHS. Quote, "Crowds outside the courthouse shouted, 'Hang the Jew!' One juror had been overheard to say before his selection for the jury, 'I am glad they indicted the goddamn Jew. They ought to take him out and lynch him. And if I get on that jury, I'll hang that Jew for sure.'" End quote. The AJHS here blends elements from several creative accounts, but variations on the above theme, as will be shown, are virtually endless. The Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, ADL, which found its raison d'etre, ostensibly, quote, "to stop the defamation of the Jewish people," end quote, in the outcome of the Frank trial, is foremost among the spreaders of this notion of mob domination. Its promotional literature claims, quote, "Hang the Jew, hang the Jew." This was the cry of the furious mob outside the Atlanta courthouse where Leo Frank, a Northern Jew, stood trial after his arrest. End quote. In 1979, an ADL official published a book containing the most outrageous claim to date. Nathan C. Belth quotes a B'nai B'rith friend of Leo Frank's who claimed to be in the courtroom during the trial. Quote, "Mobs choked the area around the courthouse. Men with rifles stood at the open windows. Some aimed at the jury, some aimed at the judge. Over and over, louder and louder, the men repeated the chant, 'Hang the Jew, hang the Jew.' The mobs kept up their chant. I can still hear them screaming through those open windows. And inside the courtroom, spectators were allowed to give free vent to their anti-Semitism. The jury was threatened with death unless it brought in a verdict of guilty. The judge was threatened with death if he didn't pass a sentence of hanging. No deputies tried to clear the windows or the courtroom. And sitting there, looking so small and forlorn, was my friend, Leo." End quote. Then there is the objective truth of the matter that, by elementary analysis, collapses this popular account of the trial into fragments of unsupportable claims, wishful thinking, and outright religious propaganda. Although Steve Oney is listed by the Anti-Defamation League as an expert on the case, he directly refuted the ADL's claim. Quote, "It didn't happen. It was something that someone wrote a couple years after the crime, and then it got stuck into subsequent recountings of the story. Jews were accepted in the city, and the record does not substantiate subsequent reports that the crowd outside the courtroom shouted at the jurors, 'Hang the Jew or we'll hang you.'" End quote. Before Oney confirmed it in his 2003 work, Mary Fagan's grandniece and namesake, Mary Fagan Keene, who spent thousands of hours examining court records and newspaper reports for her 1987 book, The Murder of Little Mary Fagan, told an interviewer, quote, "There were no bloodthirsty crowds shouting, 'Hang the Jew,' outside the courthouse." End quote. Most astounding, the alleged victim and target of this alleged violence, Leo Frank, recounted his experience at trial to the New York Times. He referred to the crowd as, quote, "unruly and boisterous," end quote. Quite common for trials of that era. But he made no mention of any anti-Semitic threats, chants, slogans, or statements. Reporters observed, quote, laughter or hisses, end quote. A, quote, murmur of applause, end quote. Quote, a stamping of feet about the room, end quote. And what Frank strangely referred to as the, quote, spirit of passionate tension, end quote. But nothing even close to the far more caustic, quote, hang the Jew, end quote, or any other anti-Semitic lynch mob rhetoric. After having experienced the entire month-long trial, Frank's attorney, Luther Rosser, addressed the jury on this very issue in his closing argument. Quote, you are without the echo of the hostile mob or overzealous friends. End quote. Leonard Dinnerstein's widely referenced book, The Leo Frank Case, is the most potent source of the hang the Jew fabrication. He even adds words and phrases that give scholars new and unique embellishment options. The Southern Poverty Law Center has included the following account in a teaching tolerance curriculum aimed at schoolchildren. Quote, at every turn, the courtroom thundered with cheers for Dorsey, boos for Frank. Each morning, as the jury walked over from a nearby hotel, the crowd chanted, hang the Jew or we'll hang you. End quote. Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, presumably a careful legal analyst, went ahead and placed the alleged threat inside the courtroom, insisting that the, quote, smell of the lynch mob was in the air, end quote, and that the gallery crowds, quote, shouted anti-Jewish epithets and demanded Frank's death, end quote. Jewish neoconservative Murray Friedman further enlarges the fable beyond that which his own source claims. He says the cry was, quote, death to the Jew, end quote. In most of the books and articles that mention the Frank case, some version of that phrase is the only, quote, presented from the two-year case history. Anatomy of a lie. Quote, when he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. End quote. Jesus speaking in John 8:44. So how does a complete fabrication become the central theme in the trial of Leo Frank for the murder of 13-year-old Mary Fagan? It starts with an understanding of the clear objective of the Leo Frank defense, to transform a duly convicted child rapist and strangler into a Jewish cause celebre. The American Israelite newspaper stated the absolute value of the, quote, anti-Semitism, end quote, charge to that objective in these stark terms. Quote, the moment the cry of hang the Jew was raised, the case was made one of interest to every Jew in the United States, end quote. And when we peel back the layers of this enduring legend, we find its source, not in the courtroom, but in the pages of Collier's Magazine in its December 17, 1914 issue. Quote, on the last day I was in Atlanta, I went to the office of one of Frank's lawyers to say goodbye. The telephone rang. If they don't hang that Jew, we'll hang you, came the message. End quote. Writer C.P. Connolly was hired by Leo Frank's propaganda team to serialize their version of the Atlanta trial and its aftermath. Neither Judge Leonard S. Roan nor Frank's lawyers nor the jurors ever mentioned receiving such, quote, communications, end quote, or, quote, threats, end quote. And though it is the first and only time this dubious incident appeared in print, even Connolly presents it as an anonymous phone call nowhere near the courtroom. And many creative embellishments certainly followed. There is no doubt that there were emotional moments at the trial, but when manifestations of this excitement interrupted the trial, there was prompt and decisive action by the judge. A Constitution reporter described one incident he witnessed where the courtroom audience applauded when Frank's attorney, Luther Rosser, admitted he had made a mistake. Quote, the deputies rapped for order, and Judge Roan gazed over the throng with astonishment. several court attachés spotted men who had applauded, and they were forthwith ejected from the room. There was pained surprise in the faces of the attorneys for both the state and the defense. They wondered, as all others wondered, why should there be applause when the procedure there, in effect, would, surely, lead one of the two men to the scaffold? End quote. Similarly, after Frank's mother, Mrs. Ray Frank, cursed the prosecutor in open court, the judge, quote, gave warning that there must be no more such demonstrations, end quote. Several news reports present an atmosphere that is quite contrary to that portrayed by the makers of the Leo Frank legend. At the beginning of the trial, an Atlanta Journal headline read, quote, "Picnic and theories mark noon hour in Frank trial courtroom," end quote. The page one article said, quote, "The room where the Frank trial is taking place has all the appearance of the pavilion at Grant Park on a hot July Saturday," end quote. The Journal, whose editor was Jewish, continued, quote, "The benches are spread with boxes and sacks, sandwiches, chicken, cake, all the other essentials of a picnic lunch, save ice-cold lemonade, are passed about from man to man, and the noon-hour dinner is eaten with as much good-natured laughter as if there was never such a thing in the world as a murder trial," end quote. When Frank himself entered the courtroom, he was accompanied by his wife and mother. Quote, "smiling cheerfully and responding to the greetings of a number of friends," end quote. The Journal offered a lengthy article titled, quote, "Playing practical jokes on watchful bailiffs is pastime of Frank jurors," end quote, reporting a relaxed and playful behind-the-scenes atmosphere. The Journal reported that, quote, "Frank, the accused man, appeared cheerful and chatted unconcernedly with friends close to him," end quote. Under the heading, quote, "Court scenes at Frank trial, how it looks inside and out," end quote. The crowd outside the courthouse was described as, quote, "a silent throng, speculating in whispers," end quote. Inside the building, the people were, quote, "laughing and chatting," end quote, before trial, and the courtroom spectators were sitting in, quote, "quiet curiosity," end quote, during the proceedings. During one long trial delay, witnesses in the witness room sang, quote, "songs of the old country church," with a zest that rocked the building with music, end quote. There was also laughter by the defendant and his wife when James Conley made a comment while on the witness stand. The Atlanta Journal carried this item during Conley's damning testimony. Quote, "Frank unconcerned. For the first time since the trial commenced, Frank and Mrs. Frank did not appear to be taking a very keen interest in the proceedings, but laughed and talked together quite a bit." End quote. The audience applause at Rosser's gaffe may have been the most serious breach of courtroom decorum in the four-week-long trial. As reported, that disruption was quickly managed, the offenders ejected, with nary an appearance of anti-religious bigotry. The Day of the Verdict. Commonly, the myth of the mob archetype depicts the most violent action occurring on the day of the verdict, August 25th. The final day of the trial, when the jury received its instructions from Judge Roan, is that moment of the court proceedings when the fury of, quote, "the mob," end quote, is said to have been at its peak. It is claimed that knife- and gun-wielding anti-Semites commandeered the courtroom, chanting to the jury, quote, "hang the Jew or we'll hang you," end quote. Of course, at no point in the trial were those caustic words spoken, nor were weapons brandished or used. And tucked away in the all-important blow-by-blow trial coverage by the Atlanta dailies is a significant observation. The Atlanta Journal reported, quote, "all women who were waiting when the doors opened were given right-of-way into court. Some 175 of them were seated before the officers began to admit the men, and not more than 50 of these latter could get in," end quote. So the proportion of 3.5 women for every man, with the women dressed in long dresses and Sunday hats, suggests that the potential for disorder or rioting was much diminished, thus moving the terror legend further and further from historical reality. But nothing argues more strongly against the charge of a violent anti-Frank courtroom uprising than the sworn testimony of Frank's most vociferous courtroom defender. Reuben Arnold witnessed the enthusiastic reaction received by Solicitor Dorsey when they both walked together through the spectators gathered for admittance to the courtroom on the final day of the trial. Arnold seized upon that reaction to call for a mistrial, which meant Arnold himself, having personally claimed to be an eyewitness, had to take the witness stand under oath. The Journal then reported, quote, "Arnold testifies. Mr. Arnold testified that as Mr. Dorsey left the courtroom Friday afternoon, he heard loud cheering in front of the courthouse. That on Saturday, he asked the solicitor not to leave the courtroom until the jury had gotten out of hearing, to which the solicitor readily agreed. That after they had waited several minutes, they thought the jury was out of hearing, and the solicitor left the courtroom with him, Mr. Arnold, walking immediately behind him. That as the solicitor stepped into the street, there were loud and excited cheers and cries of, 'Hurrah for Dorsey!' That, in his judgment, these cries could have been heard as far as Alabama Street. On cross-examination by Attorney Hooper, Mr. Arnold testified that he did not know where the jury was at the time, except by information, that he did not hear this trial mentioned by the crowd, and that he did not hear the crowd mention Frank's name." End quote. Arnold, under oath, described the crowd as expressing, quote, "approbation," end quote, for Dorsey's courtroom expertise. Arnold mentioned no threats, no violence, no intimidation, and nothing even remotely related to anti-Semitism. Frank himself was returned to his jail cell, where he and his wife were, quote, "talking and smiling," end quote, before she, quote, "kissed him, smiling brightly," end quote. Judge Roan denied the motion for a mistrial. And now that Oney's 2003 book, And the Dead Shall Rise, has become the standard work on the topic, a very interesting thing has happened. The, quote, "chanting mob," end quote, has vanished as mysteriously as it arrived, suddenly dropped from all the latest works by pro-Frank writers. The recently published Encyclopedia of American Jewish History, 2008, doesn't repeat the charge at all. Atlanta's own William Brayman Jewish Heritage Museum opened an exhibit in 2008 that it considers, quote, "the last word," end quote, on the Leo Frank case. The exhibition catalog, edited by Jane Levy, features the writings of several scholars, including Eli N. Evans, Andy Ambrose, Clifford Kuhn, Steve Oney, Matthew H. Bernstein, and Leonard Dinnerstein, none of whom repeats the claim that used to be central to the Leo Frank legend. The Brayman has offered no explanation for the dropped claim. The 2009 PBS television docudrama by Ben Loderman goes even further in its production and depicts the courtroom audience as orderly and attentive, which, by all newspaper accounts, they were. It should also be noted that after Frank's trial, there were several official court hearings and appeals, fully discussed in the daily papers, at which there were no crowds, no threats, and no disturbances, not even pickets or protesters, nor were there any marches or rallies. All the judicial proceedings decided against Frank without the help of an intimidating mob. Once Frank's 22 months of appeals were exhausted and his execution imminent, Governor John Slayton, in June of 1915, held clemency hearings, where he considered commuting or vacating the sentence, or even pardoning the convict. This is where one might expect the most flagrant manifestations of the fervent hate and violence claimed by so many of the Jewish framers of the case. Not so. Again, There was not even a protest at any time during the well-advertised gubernatorial hearing reported on by all the Atlanta newspapers. Once the governor commuted Frank's sentence on June 21, 1915, violence did break out and threats were issued, but not against Leo Frank or the Jews of Atlanta. All of the rage was vented at the governor himself, who had to call out the National Guard for his own protection. Albert Lindemann accurately stated, quote, "A mob formed in town. But rather than attack Jews or their property, it marched to the governor's mansion armed with an array of weapons, including dynamite." End quote. Emphasis ours. At a demonstration, a sign was affixed to an effigy which read, quote, "Slayton, King of Jews," end quote. But, quote, "overt or concrete manifestations of anti-Semitism were few," end quote. The Leo Frank home, the National Pencil Company factory, the houses, businesses, and synagogues of everyone associated with Frank's defense, lawyers, witnesses, family, friends, employees, B'nai B'rith associates, were never threatened or disturbed. Did the Atlanta press hang the Jew? Windows, quote, "were broken, and storefronts were painted. It was a mini Kristallnacht. That whole proud notion of being Southern and Confederates and Jews was called into question. Those three used to go along happily together," end quote. Ben Loderman. The three Atlanta daily newspapers covering the trial have been accused of fueling an anti-Semitic frenzy leading to Leo Frank's conviction and ultimate lynching. But the detailed daily accounts by the Constitution, the Georgian, and the Journal reflect no anti-Jewish sentiment at all. Incredibly, their reportage, taken as a whole, can be shown to be unreservedly pro-Leo Frank. And that pro-Frank bias can be tracked from the very first report of the discovery of the dead body of 13-year-old Mary Fagan. An analysis of those early news reports shows that they were actually protective of Leo Frank, refusing to cast suspicion on him. One paper, for instance, reported that four men were, quote, "arrested," end quote, but that Frank was merely, quote, "summoned to police headquarters," end quote. A Georgian report announced that, quote, "guilt will be fixed by night," end quote, and discusses at length the four Gentile suspects. Quote, "Newtley and Gordon Bailey, both black, and Arthur Mullinax and James Gant, both white," end quote. But it did not even mention Frank, though he was then in custody. The front page of the April 30th edition, extra number 8, of the Georgian is titled, quote, "Suspicion lifts from F," end quote, and quotes detectives, quote, "We now have enough evidence to convict Newt Lee," end quote. Most troubling is the following passage. Quote, "The statement came at the end of a second-long conference between John Black, city detective, Harry Scott, Pinkerton detective, and Leo Frank, superintendent of the National Pencil Company factory. Additional clues furnished by the head of the pencil factory were responsible for the closing net around the Negro watchman." What suspicion had rested on Frank was being rapidly swept away by the damaging evidence against the black man. It was announced that he, end quote, Frank, quote, "probably would be liberated tonight or in the morning. It looks a great deal better for Frank, who has been detained only for his own protection, and to furnish further information to the department," said the detectives, end quote. The newspaper further took great pains to clear Frank of suspicion. Quote, "The police say that Frank is not under arrest, that he was put under police guard for his own personal safety, and that there are no charges against him," end quote. Frank was presented in the report as aiding the investigation, even conferring with detectives on investigative matters. At this stage, when anti-Semitism should have been at its height, as was later claimed, just the opposite is found. A Jewish man is actually supplying the information that fuels a potential mob lynching of an innocent black man, Knute Lee. Once the investigation resulted in the indictment of Leo Frank, the three Atlanta dailies meticulously followed the trial testimony and the surrounding events. In fact, there was no trial in recent memory in which the print media dedicated as much effort to both reporting and analysis as did the Atlanta newspapers in 1913. Later writers on the case nevertheless appear to have invented a narrative that has little to do with what was actually printed at the time of the trial. Harry Golden's 1965 book, A Little Girl is Dead, claims that, quote, "The newspapers were filled with the most awful stories, affidavits, and testimonies, which proved the guilt of Leo M. Frank beyond the shadow of a doubt," end quote. More recently, Dartmouth professor Michael Bronsky's 2005 article referred to, quote, "the virulent anti-Semitic atmosphere of the city and the local media," end quote. In 2010, Elaine Marie Alfin, author of An Unspeakable Crime, claimed that, quote, "the front page of the Monday Morning Georgian showed a horrifying photograph of Mary's body on the slab at the undertaker's," end quote. But that issue of the Georgian has no, quote, "horrifying photograph," end quote, and specifically casts suspicion for the murder on the four Christian suspects then under arrest, and not on Leo Frank. And no such photograph appears in the Georgian on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. Also, Alfin fails to mention that at the time of Mary Fagan's murder and Leo Frank's trial, the city editor of the Georgian was Michael, Mike, D. Clofine, a Northern Jew. The Georgian's competition, the Atlanta Constitution, quote, "had a Jewish editor and had been, in preceding years, a central vehicle for favorable reporting about Atlanta's Jewish community," end quote. Similarly, John Cohen, the son of a rabbi, was the longtime senior editor at the Atlanta Journal, and described as, quote, "high in the councils of the Ku Klux Klan," end quote. He was one of several newspaper editors who had, quote, "whipped whites into a frenzy," end quote, of race hate that ultimately led to the Atlanta Massacre of 1906, which claimed the lives of 50 blacks, left 150 wounded, and caused over 1,000 to flee the city. In 1905, Cohen's paper serialized Thomas Dixon's racist novel, Klansmen, which glorifies the violent terrorism of the Ku Klux Klan and asserts that blacks in America represented a lethal threat to white society. So perversely captivating was the book that it became the inspiration for the most racially destructive movie ever made, The Birth of a Nation. As Oney points out, after Hearst's Georgian appeared to sensationalize the case at Frank's expense, quote, "a protest by the city's Jews prompted the Hearst paper to reverse course. Thereafter, it not only editorialized in Frank's behalf, but slanted news stories in his favor," end quote. And from then on, Oney continues, quote, "to the extent that there was bias in the coverage, it was mostly in Frank's favor, as both the Georgian and the Journal, evincing the prejudices of the time, ridiculed the state's star witness, a black factory janitor named Jim Conley," end quote. Leo Frank's own lawyer, Luther Rosser, stopped the proceedings in mid-trial to declare, quote, "these boys over at the press table do their best to get accurate facts," end quote. Rosser thus provides our best indication that the Frank team was essentially satisfied with the coverage they had received in the 13 weeks since the murder. After his August 1913 conviction, Frank's lawyers began filing appeals, and at an October hearing, Reuben Arnold freely denounced and derided the judge, the jury, the spectators, and the witnesses in the strongest language. He specifically wanted the judge to juxtapose that assessment against the behavior of the press. Quote, "The newspapers have tried to report the case with justice for everybody." End quote. During that same tumultuous period, Jewish merchants freely placed paid advertisements for their businesses in all three dailies. A review of their pages before, during, and after the trial reveals no change in the frequency, size, or message of these advertisements. One might expect that Jewish merchants and business leaders, many of whom were certainly B'nai B'rith members, would express their righteous anger at those supposedly bigoted dailies by simply withdrawing their advertising dollars, which were a significant revenue stream for all the Atlanta newspapers. The mammoth, Jewish-owned Rich's department store had large ads in nearly every issue of the Atlanta papers during the Frank trial. The Southern Merchants Association convened in the city at the same time as the trial, and the ads from Jewish businesses targeting the attendees were as prominent as ever. Among those were Regensteins, Bass's Dry Goods, Jacob's Pharmacy, E. H. Cohn Incorporated, Friedman & Cohen, Adler Rochester, Hart & Schaffner, L. C. Adler's Clothing, Liebman's, J. Eisman & Sons, J. J. Bauer, J. N. Hirsch Brothers, Frosen's, Essig Brothers, Liebman Real Estate, Stein Bloch Suits, Julius Kaiser, Warner's, Meyer and Burkle Incorporated, Zabon's, Daniel Brothers, Berkowitz, Wolfsheimer's, C.C. Rosenbaum. Most revealing, however, is the advertisement that appeared on the very day that Leo Frank was convicted of the murder of Mary Fagan. It was placed by Montag Brothers Office Supply Company, the owner of the National Pencil Company, the convict's employer. The Montags were heavily invested in defending Leo Frank, and it was Sig Montag himself who employed the Pinkerton Detective Agency the day after the murder was discovered. It is unlikely that the Montags would advertise in an anti-Semitic newspaper, much less one that is persecuting its own Jewish employee. Montag Brothers previously had placed another ad in the Atlanta Journal on August 5, 1913, the same day as the sensational testimony of James Conley, urging readers to choose the company to, quote, "buy your school supplies," end quote. Rich's department store ever so distastefully advertised the sale of, quote, "silver mesh bags," end quote, for women, the same type of handbag that Mary Fagan was carrying on the day she was murdered. Testimony had shown that she had left home with the purse, but it was never recovered. So Rich's marketing of this particular style of handbag, and placing it in the center of the retail store's main floor, was no coincidence. In the very issue, August 26, 1913, of the Atlanta Georgian that carried Judge Roan's death sentence for Frank, Rich's announced that it had entered the last week of its, quote, "August furniture sale," end quote. A University of Georgia study showed the trial coverage and the supporting illustrations to be pro-Frank in character and content, with anti-Semitism being undetectable in even trace amounts. The newspaper's ambivalence about the inclusion of James Conley's testimony was plainly expressed, and their coverage of all blacks involved in the trial was riddled with incendiary stereotypes and terms like, quote, "nigger," end quote, and, quote, "darky," end quote. L. F. Woodruff's commentary on Conley in the Atlanta Georgian truly says it all. He titled it, quote, "Traditions of the South Upset. White man's life hangs on Negro's word." He is a Negro of the type that the South has been trying since Reconstruction to destroy. The meagerly educated, shiftless, gin-guzzling, half-anthropoid black that any nation could well be rid of. End quote. No such language can be found to describe either the man on trial for murder or his religion. The fact is that all three local dailies, the Atlanta Constitution, the Atlanta Journal, and the Atlanta Georgian, provide no examples of anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic bias before, during, or after the trial, conviction, and lynching of Leo M. Frank. Not only was the press openly racist as a matter of tradition, but they reported lynchings as routine matters of folk justice. During the period of the Frank trial, articles regularly appeared describing efforts to remove blacks from government positions simply because they were, quote, Negro, end quote. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.